Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a recovery conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Recovery, as in successfully living and thriving, free from previous addiction to alcohol or drugs. There are over 22 million Americans in recovery. They reach their recovery through unique journeys. Only 17% recover through medical services. The majority use different methods. I think this group of Americans hold the secret to success and who we need to study. They hold the key to implementing effective recovery and treatment solutions to people who are currently struggling. There's no one-size-fits-all solution. Each individual has their unique story. However, learning and understanding about the patterns of success from those in recovery is important for improving addiction treatment. To learn more about recovery, I reached out to a man who was eager to share his story, Sean Hemion. Sean Hemion's a man in recovery with a career as an actor, writer, and artist. You can see him in TV shows such as 911, Criminal Minds, True Blood, and CW's The Husbands. Originally from Northern Virginia, Sean now lives in Los Angeles with his husband and two Boston Terriers. Sean reached out to me to debut his memoir, The Good Little Drug Lord. His story describes his times as a Mormon drug dealer who found redemption as a narc for the federal government. He confronted the Russian mafia, his darkest self, his mother, and the mother of a young man who died because he failed to act. To learn more about Sean Hemion and The Good Little Drug Lord, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Sean on January 30th, 2025. Sean Hemion, welcome to High Truths.
Hi, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
I thank you. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I get a lot of different requests through the High Truths website of people want to be on the show. Some of that has worked out, some hasn't, but I'm really excited and thankful that you reached out. And I was attracted to your story coming from a Mormon community. Uh-huh. And I'm, like I said, I'm close to the Hasidic Jewish community, very insular. You know, if you look on the outside, it seems very wholesome, but I know as a professional that drugs addiction hit all communities no matter what. So let's start with your story. Tell me, start with your childhood. Are you one, as a Mormon, are you like one of, 10 children?
You know, on my mom's side of the family, I have 60 some odd cousins, and now they all have like a bazillion kids. So it's like 120. It's just because my mom came from a family of seven, but and I came from a family of seven. I'm a middle child of seven. So that was a good guess. I love this question. Let's just start with your childhood. Let's just jump right in. It's like, oh boy. I think the thing that's so unique to my story is, yes, I was raised Mormon. However, or in addition to, my very Mormon pilgrim mother, came out of Utah, and somehow in Northern Virginia, she crashed into my very non-Mormon, very Irish Catholic father, who also incidentally came from a family of seven. And they crashed together and out came these seven kids. My mom was running from, she was like the queen bee at BYU. She was dating like the quarterback BYU star. But here's some scandal for you. The guy was busted for dealing steroids. So the star quarterback at BYU in the, gosh, mom, when
Cheating.
was this? Like in the 70s or something. Anyway, it was just terrible. And so my mom got shoved on a plane back to her parents. But because she was Mormon with a very Mormon father, and because she got a divorce, he wouldn't talk to her. It was like, come on, man.
Because
So, you know.
why wouldn't he talk to her? Because she dated?
Because she got a divorce. And in the Mormon church, that's like, I mean, now it's a little bit more progressive, but not in the 70s. Heck no. So he wouldn't talk to her. And so she's very wounded and got very charmed
Yes.
by my very charming father. And they got married 4 months later. So I was raised to be a Mormon, and I was a good little Mormon boy for my mother. However, I had a father that would make fun of the church. I mean, he would come sometimes, but like it would be like I'd go to Sunday school and it's like, you know, don't drink, don't watch rated R movies, don't smoke cigarettes, don't, you know. And then I'd come home and my father would be like, get the, I don't know, can we curse? Get the F out of the way of my rated R movie. You know, he was from New England. So he'd be drinking his beer. So it was very confusing. But I always sided with my mother's, and I really tried hard to believe in the Mormon religion and the Mormon God. So I was a Mormon, but I just had this weird contrast. And he brought in the alcoholism. So I had that mix into it. Now, that being said, to your lead-in question, my cousins, there's so much addiction, and they come from full Mormon parents and full Mormon upbringings. And so it is very prevalent in the Mormon community, and they do not want to talk about it. I think at one point, Utah had like the leading amount use of antidepressants for per state, like in the country or something. I could be
Wow.
fact-checked on that, but I definitely remember talking to an organization about that when I was doing a fundraiser there and stuff. So it's there. I mean, people.
What about your brother and sisters? What kind of role model were they sharing with you?
So my eldest was the good Mormon. Incidentally, none of my siblings were Mormon anymore. Just my mother. After she left my father, she married another Mormon man. But my eldest brother was the good Mormon. Was this, you know, was the he was the golden boy. He was the oldest boy. So he went on his mission, went to BYU, went off on his own. Now I'm the middle, so the two between us, in his shadow, just couldn't meet it and d decided that being popular in high school was more important. And at that time, especially in the 90s, you were made fun of if you said you were Mormon. Most of the Mormons I knew that I went to Sunday school with that were at my high school, like, were kind of shunned. And so I, that my brothers completely, they left the church in high
If you
school.
went to public school, I remember that because I sent my children to public school, and I wanted, and they went to a religious, grade school, and I wanted them to dress more modestly, and I remember they're saying like, "No, that means you're a Mormon." I could get
That's
that.
so funny. I mean, especially then, I mean, people ever since the founding of the Mormon religion in 1830, people have been skeptical and made fun of this religion. That's just what it is. And to the Mormons, that proves that it's a true church, which is its own thing. So we have more understanding of it now. It's more in the pop culture, especially, you know, you see TV shows that have Mormon characters or the Book of Mormon musical. But in the 90s, you didn't have as much of it in the pop culture. So people really went to like crazy places with how they saw Mormons. I think they were mostly just scared of them, but their way of dealing with that was just to make fun of them. And so it was very uncool to be like Mormons were weird. Weird. And so you were almost shunned, or you kept it a secret, or you left the church and you made fun of it yourself, which is, I mean, I started realizing I was gay at 13, which is
That's not cool. In the, that's worse than divorce.
it's worse than murder. I mean, it is, you know, and it's also very, very uncool in the 90s to be gay. So it was like, great, another thing to hide. But it was the thing that compelled me to, you know, not compel me to repel the Mormon religion. So by the time I was 16, I really pulled back from going, and believing. I was just in too much pain because the Mormon God that I believed in, was somehow cursing me with what I called it at that time, the disease of gayness. Like I was being punished. This is what my 13-year-old brain was thinking. I was being punished for some terrible thing that I must have done to God, that it's so bad he won't even tell me what it is. Instead, he's just going to curse me with this gayness and punish me for this, because that's all I thought that it was. And that's what I was running on. But by the time I was like 16, I had a little bit more wherewithal to be like, okay, maybe the Mormons don't have this all together. Funny enough, that's also like, the Mormons, their high school kids, they send them to seminary. So before 16-year-olds, we need sleep more than anything, but you're going to make us get up at 5 a.m., go to church for an hour, and then go to high school after, going to a full day of school and football practice. I thought that was kind of the thing that really broke me, was like, this is insane. My whole freshman year going to seminary, going to church for an hour before school. I was falling asleep in school. I was falling all over myself. But that was the thing that really, like, as funny as that is, as simple as that,
Yeah,
but it was
yeah.
just like,
But I think the wisdom behind that is to keep you busy. Kids at that age need to be kept busy to be kept out of trouble. So
oh.
if you go to church and go to these activities, then maybe that'll keep you out of
If you want to
same
keep,
problem.
yeah, if you wanted to keep me out of trouble, then please do me a favor and ask me how I'm feeling and tell me it's safe to tell you how I really am feeling, because I did not have anybody to talk to. I was profoundly alone, and hence why by the time, my first sip of alcohol or weed was like 13, 14. My two older brothers were already smoking cigarettes. They were already, I pretended to catch them, and they were like, "Well, you can have a sip of the alcohol if you don't tell mom." And I was like, "Sure." And then, so by the time I was a freshman, I already knew that alcohol equals feeling good, and I don't have this existential torment, this self-loathing, this shame, at least for the period that I'm drinking or subdued with really bad weed or something like that.
Yeah. So what was the very first drug you ever tried? Was it alcohol or weed or both?
It was alcohol. Well, I guess if you want to count cigarettes as a drug, I mean, nicotine is a
Yeah.
drug.
Yeah.
That one was, man, that one was very young. That one was, gosh, how old are you in first grade? 9, 10, 8? I
Eight,
can't
yeah.
remember. I remember, and already my brother, the brother below, the superstar brother, he was like the black sheep, the bad kid from very early on. So I remember catching him. He was like 6th or 7th grade smoking with his friends, and they thought it would be cool to see me like take a puff of a cigarette at like 8 or 9. But I got it, but that went away. But at 13, smoking with my brothers, I thought was very cool. So I quickly became addicted to cigarettes at 13. At that same time was my very first sip of alcohol with the brother right above me, and his friends thought it would be very, they're 16. I'm 13. They thought it would be cool for me to drink with them. And the thing about my father, God bless him, a paycheck father, meaning like the dude was busy trying to support 7 kids, which is insanity. Of course he was angry all the time. Of course he was stomping around and you sort of checked out. My mother was very gullible. My mother was very, she didn't have the street smarts that my dad did. So that very first drinking behind our elementary school, I probably had 2 beers, but it was enough to get me really drunk. I remember coming home and just being all smiles and cheers and just kind of goofing off with my mom and realizing she has no idea that I am drunk in front of her. And I was like, cool, I know how to hide this now. This feels good. This is what I'm going to be doing.
Yeah.
And
So your older brothers are the ones who corrupted little Sean.
pretty much, yeah,
Yeah.
it was almost like a rite of passage, because even though the eldest brother, by the way, went off to become a good Mormon, before he did that, he corrupted the one below him, and that one corrupted the one below him, and that one corrupted. It was how we bonded. It was, that's typical. I mean, a lot of brothers,
And there are no eyes on you to see that you're getting into trouble at a young age from your mom or dad or parents at school or
No, it's just too over
church.
it's just too overwhelming. It's just far too it's far too overwhelming. And then also when I started seeing the distance between, who I really was, meaning a, little gay boy, and what my mother and the Mormon religion believed, the further into myself I retreated, the further I feared anybody discovering my secrets, so I wasn't going to ask for help, even though I desperately needed it.
Yeah. You know, most people who get into addiction, not all, have suffered adverse childhood events, some type of abuse. And I'm wondering, besides having this secret or identity that didn't flow with the Mormon doctrine, if other things happened to you.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's interesting. I as a screenwriter, especially as a screenwriter, there it's always easiest when you're telling a story that the origin is like one incident. It's easier for us to watch that and just to like associate like that one incident is the thing he needs to overcome like the rest of the movie. But as you know, and I'm sure your listeners, it's like repeated things that happen throughout our childhood that really accumulate. But there are, I mean, there's certain things like when I was 3 or 4 being we moved from one house to the other house a mile away, and I was left behind, and I walked the whole way after waiting for them, and then coming around the corner and realizing they didn't even notice I was gone was all the messaging I needed to feel like I did not matter to any of these people, and I needed to fight for their attention. And then every experience after that just sort of acted to reaffirm this belief. Like I needed to fight for my mother's love to the point where I call it not I call it it's it is it was covert incest, meaning not sexual. It was, since my father was alcoholic and checked out, my mother leaned on me specifically for her emotional well-being. So I was almost like in a relationship with my mother, which corrupts the child because everything becomes about her. I don't know what my needs are. I don't know what's happening on the inside of me. It's all about her. And nothing to do with what my needs are. And that's why that was honestly, I think, I've been in recovery for 20 years, so I've talked about this a lot. But that's why I think I was so dedicated to the Mormon religion, because she was so codependent on the religion. Therefore, I needed to be her best little Mormon boy ever.
Yeah.
That accumulated again till other things happened. But when I was 13, I was probably one of the first online sexual predator victims, because as I already described, I was incredibly lonely. I had nobody to, I had nothing. And then suddenly the advent of AOL, and oh my goodness, there's these chat rooms and there's M4M, and it's like you think you're talking to another 14, 15-year-old boy, but it turns out, oh, it's a 35-year-old man who is grooming me to meet him, and I do, and it
Oh.
yeah, and it set me up for, sexual abuse at that age just sexualizes you. It sets you up for all kinds of things. And so the takeaway from that experience though was that I deserve this because this God cursed me with this, and I'm totally acting in the way the Mormons expect me to. I don't know if I can curse, but I'm a piece of poop. Like I'm a piece of shit. Like I deserve this. And so no 13-year-old should want to die like that. And so it makes sense then when I had my first sip of alcohol around that same time, all that gets washed away.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is this? Why can't I feel like this all the time?
Yeah. Did anybody get in trouble? I mean, you're subject of a criminal behavior. Did they catch the people who did that to you?
Well, for me to reveal that, for me to say that would have to have been revealing that, I had these inclinations.
No, but now looking back.
Oh my
I
God. I
mean,
mean,
those people
how?
are hurting other people. I'm sure you
Sure.
weren't his their only victim.
That was 1993. So I don't know. I have no idea how. No idea. No idea how they, I mean, God bless them and their journey and where they are and if they harmed another person. But I don't, the answer is I have no idea how to get them in trouble. It wasn't until recovery 10 years later where I even just started whispering about the incident. So that's 10 years later. And so who knows where that person was, or, I mean, and I knew nothing about the person other than their screen name, or the car they drove, but
So you're describing a childhood where you were really unsupervised.
very unsupervised. Oh my gosh. Again, my parents extremely overwhelmed. She was so hyper focused and codependent on the religion and my father that it left us in the backgrounds to kind of babysit and raise ourselves. And we were all very capable, you know. Surprisingly, I got really good grades, but that was just to prove I was okay. And but generally, with that amount of kids, it is kind of a free
Yeah.
for all.
I mean, anything good from the religion? It seems like your mom, your I know that you also called it, you've been a victim of various abuses, but I noticed you called it also religious abuse. So I wonder what you mean by that.
Sure. I don't know if there could ever be a world like I get the intention of wanting to raise your child in something you believe is good, something you believe will give them morals, something that you believe will help them. That intention is good. It is pure. But I also feel like the indoctrination that can occur from that. I mean, we're experiencing dissonance in our country just on a political spectrum based on this whole thing of, this whole idea of indoctrinating children. So it's like they don't have a choice other than to believe what you're the parent. So of course they're going to take it all on, no matter what it is. And then later they get to decide. I wish there was a world where they could have B18 and decide, and most of them do. But I say, so I just, there's some level of that feels abusive when the religious point of views that's trying to be indoctrinated ultimately do not align with who you truly are or what you truly believe. And
Yeah.
it's abusive on that level because of the amount. I mean, I've already
That added to
described
your guilt. You are somebody who God
profound
hates.
shame. Yeah,
Right.
exactly. I mean, this whole idea, this whole
I
profound shame.
that's yeah. I'm
So
wondering if you were, and then I don't know if it's the religion, it's the reinterpretation of the religion where you right away you describe a childhood where you felt bad and that God is punishing you instead of being indoctrinating, which hopefully I did for my children, because I am I'm a religious person, but that God loves you no matter what, and He's got your back no matter what, even in tough times.
so I What's interesting, so my mother and I, we have come, I love her more today, and I have the best relationship with her today than I ever have. And I mean,
Amazing what 20 years does.
well, I mean, look, when I came out to her at 19, it was after self-harm, like, which, could have been suicide if I went. It came after an episode of that. I came out to her, and her first words to me were, "Do you have AIDS?" And my mouth dropped. I was like, "That's the first thing you're gonna ask." And then she starts crying because she's not gonna have grandchildren. Anyway, that's just an example of the naivety of what she understood and meant to be gay. All that being said,
But also it was her, I feel like depression is extremely selfish. It was selfish of her, like, I'm not gonna have grandchildren, right?
correct. Cut to, then, 2 years ago, 2023, my mother is walking me down the aisle of my very gay wedding, and she loves my husband more than me today. So I'm saying that because, to your point, that like I think in all religions, there has to be some kernel of truth. All new age, even, I mean, and that's how cults get started, because they're borrowing truths that like resonate on some deeper level. I think, there's like, religions are like spokes on a wheel. There's many ways to the center, and whatever yours is yours. And so, but I think it's also in the interpretation of that can be really harmful, like you were saying. So,
Yeah.
like, you could be lucky to have you as a mother who interprets it in a way of, loving all. Or you could have the interpretation of my very conditional love. Of the Mormons, I want to say. I mean, I will say it's conditional, but if I, another practicing Mormon today will say, "No, it's unconditional. We love all. We just don't like the behavior." And to me, that's still very conditional.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's tough. It could do, but you're right. It could do a lot of good, but if taken the wrong way, it could do a lot of bad and even evil, right? We've had a lot of wars around throughout our history done in the name of God. I guess
case in point. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Did you, was there a rock bottom, you know, like as far as the story, you say that, you know, that true also, like you said, there's not always a rock bottom. It's good for the movies and for the shows, but did that happen to you?
Oh Lord. Rock bottom. I probably had multiple rock bottoms. You know, I reached out to you because I'm starting to promote a book that I guess you could say is about my rock bottom of many rock bottoms. And I don't even know how to answer that because let me ask you this. What would you define as a rock bottom? Like, what does that mean to you and all your experience with the podcast? Because then
I guess my experience typically would be like, that's it. I got caught. I'm in jail. I got nothing. I've already been to rehab 3 times and something happened to me while I was in jail. Okay. And then I decide, okay, I'm going to change. To be honest, another pattern that's not really recognized when people, I don't know if it's bottom or deciding to change, there's an age component, right? Your brain is not done growing until you're 25. And sometimes people need those years for their brain to grow, to realize, okay, I do have something to look forward to change.
Right, right. Well, okay. So, okay, that's helpful because, you know, obviously I've already mentioned I've been in recovery for 20 years. And so I have people and I have done it through the 12-step rooms and, you know, other modalities and stuff. And so I've heard many recovery stories through the years, and the level of people's bottoms is personal to them. Their bottom is their bottom. My bottom had to go where it went. And so my, I'm going to do a summary. Because like I said, I reached out to you about the book, and the book is about I go forward in time and I go backwards in time. I go forward in time through the thrilling rise and fall of this former gay Mormon who decides he, like I said, wants to feel that way all the time. Because at 19, after the terrible coming out, he discovers more and more party drugs. At that time, it was like more cocaine and ketamine and ecstasy. Then meets a drug dealer and gets introduced to crystal meth and a party drug called GHB. And becomes enthralled with the... I'm speaking of myself in third person, but we're going to go with it. Becomes enthralled with the underbelly, the CD, the drug dealing world, all the stuff I watched in the movies is now happening in front of me. And I'm thinking this is the coolest thing ever. That became its own thrill. And then realizing this drug dealer boyfriend is sucks at dealing and I'm going to take all of his business. But really he can't keep up with my increasing habit. Now I'm using meth every day. I'm failing out of theater school.
How old are you?
Now I'm 21. I'm about to be 22. So about, okay. Just about to be 22.
Yeah. Your brain's still not done.
Still not done. Still thinks, he's invincible. Still thinks none of the consequences could or would ever happen. Thinks, and most especially, this is what leads to the bottom, still believes he can stop whenever he wants to. And he has his whole life ahead of him. But right now, we're just going to feel good about this. Not even paying attention to the fact that I forgot what it was like to take a sober breath. By this point, I'm about to fail out of my final semester of theater school because of attendance. And already being very high in my acting classes all the time. And this is back in DC. I went to school in Richmond, so I was always going back and forth. Anyway.
Who are you living with? Were you living with your mom at the time or no?
Well, I had a place in Richmond for school, but drug dealer boyfriend in the glamorous life, he would live in hotels. Like, he'd get a new hotel every couple of days. So basically, I was living in the hotels of DC, zooming back down to whatever apartment I had down there to like do my classes and then zoom back up. And I maintained that until one time I fell asleep at the wheel and drove my car under a Mack truck and somehow walked away from that. And that was also about the same time when the, when I left the drug dealer boyfriend and said, but really my, he couldn't, but really, he couldn't keep up with my addiction. And I thought he sucked at dealing. So I was going to go do the dealing to keep up with my growing addiction, which I didn't want to admit was a growing addiction. So, but that was short-lived because as I was proving him wrong and taking his clients and being glamorous and living in hotels for the month of January and February, the cops found me and I was arrested. And you would think this is a bottom. You would think this is, you know, a wake-up call. But I was caught with enough. This is DC. I was caught with enough. Everything is charged automatically federally in DC, which brings up the charges. And you know, it was supposed to be, you know, if I was charged, maybe a couple years in prison, but then suddenly, you know, I had a mandatory debrief with these agents, these federal agents, and they're threatening 10 plus years. And in so many words, are telling me that I need to be their informant and I need to give them information or else I'm going to jail for so many years. So suddenly, what could have been a bottom, walking away from this experience, I'm kind of thrust back into this lifestyle on a bigger scale because I needed to start. This is so crazy. I needed to start dealing on a level that would give me some kind of intel. Anyway, I'm going to leave a lot of this for the book because I just, the bottom occurred. And I'm so sorry for your listeners because I'm skipping over some thrilling
Well,
material.
they're going to have to read the book.
I'm not doing it purposefully. I'm just trying to get to the answer in a succinct kind of like in a in you know in a summarized way. But I had this chunk of months before my sentencing, and I had to find somebody to rat on. But of course, I watched all the movies, and I was like, I can't live with the shame of being a rat. So I was always sort of just wrestling with that. But nobody would deal with me in DC because they all knew I was arrested. So I started trafficking drugs through airports, which is stupid and insane, and bringing them back and then building my business back up. But on one of those trips, and this is relevant because this also could have been and should have been a bottom. On one of those trips, a young man died on my watch. I gave him drugs. He died in front of me. And
From fentanyl?
no. So, by the way, I got out before fentanyl. I got out before this crystal meth supposedly is like 10 times more potent. So, this is like early 2000s. So, fentanyl didn't even really wasn't on the radar for people. What he ultimately died from was an overdose of GHB and alcohol, which is a toxic lethal mix. And the
I've treated a lot of patients with that. If you catch it early, it's so reversible. So somebody didn't call 911. So sad.
So, but the GH for us out there with the users and your experience with this, we were always the most cautious about GHB. We knew all the rules around it. We knew all that kind of stuff. We knew definitely knew not to mix alcohol. But this young man who I met this one weekend in Atlanta through my supplier at that time, he, by the way, this is, I'm gonna share this real quick because this is the reason I actually wrote the book and it'll make sense in a moment. But I met him that night. He's very attractive. We were probably going to get together. So I kept feeding him GHB. But at one moment, he left. And that's when my supplier friend informed me that that guy was very depressed because his boyfriend's religious family wouldn't let him see his boyfriend who was in the hospital, like on his deathbed. It was very sad. And that's why we think he drank alcohol and then came back to us. And then throughout the night, it became evident as he was passing out that something was not right. But my very high, very paranoid, very skeptical mind that these consequences wouldn't happen to me, waited too long to call 911. So by the time it became clear with his very blue face and all the sign, like he was not alive, we panicked finally, saying the panic overcame all paranoia and inebriation or anything. And we zoomed. I mean, we were going down like a one-way street to the hospital a few miles away. And at that moment, I remembered I knew CPR from being a lifeguard. I jumped back and I started doing CPR, and bile starts coming up, and I'm like flying back. Anyway, it was a terrible experience that ended in a very movie cliche moment. We literally dropped his body at the ER and ran away. And the reason I go backwards in time in my book is so that I can understand my history. I thought I was a good person, and I am a good person, but how the F does that happen? How could I do that? Not only that, and this is the real motivation
Because
for
you
the
weren't
book.
you. Your brain
I
is
know.
hijacked.
I totally get that. I totally, and I've shared
Yeah.
this, and that's what everybody said. And I know that wasn't me, but at the same time, it's like I'm still feeling the regret. And 2 weeks later, I get a phone call from, random phone call. I was the last phone number on this young man's phone bill. And this woman, I mean, deep south, she's like Alabama. She's like, please don't hang up, like deep south. And I'm like, who is this? What? And she's like, please, I just want to know what happened to my son. And all these thoughts are racing through my mind. And finally I realized, oh my God, this is his mother. And I went into paranoia. Is this the cops trying to, catch me? Is like all these different things. The woman just wanted to know what happened to her son. That's it. She just wanted to know what happened. Obviously, the ER was like, yes, he had, these things in his system. He OD'd. But what led to that? I was so paranoid. And this is my biggest regret. This should have been a bottom.
What drugs were you using at the time?
So at the time, my baseline was crystal meth. So by this time, I'm smoking it 24/7. I would do GHB every couple hours in order to feel some kind of feeling, happiness. And then if I really wanted to go to the clubs, on top of these were those two were my baseline. I would do ecstasy. Rarely would I do ketamine because I had a terrible attempted rape experience on it. So ketamine was like over there. So I would do ecstasy, many pills of ecstasy at the club on top of the GHB and the meth. Those were the baseline.
Yeah, nope, not pot and alcohol anymore.
Well,
Because, or you don't even consider that a drug, because.
No. It was no. I'm laughing because I remember, my last year and a half being so proud of the fact that I didn't drink because, I had such trouble controlling my alcohol before, and I was so proud of the fact that I didn't drink anymore. So no, I did not drink alcohol because it was too dangerous with the GHB. And then every time I did weed, it would like bring me down. It was such a novel thing to do that would bring me back to myself before being this glamorous drug dealer, and it made me so sad. So I kind of those were like over there. But the mother, I hung up on her and I didn't tell her anything. And a year later, after getting sober, I tried to find her. And then while writing the book, I tried to find her. And so the book is kind of like a message in a bottle because I have a whole chapter just for her son. So I just like the fantasy is that she gets this book. She finally gets to hear what happens to her son. But you would think that's a bottom. No. Ultimately, okay, I'll just get to this. Ultimately, when I was faced with my sentencing, by the point I had to face my sentencing, I was being supplied drugs by a supposed Russian mafia tie, and I was thinking about informing on this person, realizing again, I've watched all the movies, like, oh my God, what if they come for my family? What if they come for me? So, and then I started really suspecting, like, I don't think I can stop on my own. I deserve prison. I'm a piece of sh dog poop. I don't know if I can curse. I'm a terrible, terrible person because
By
I
the way, I'm
want
not
to do that.
answering you because at the I usually put these podcasts as normal, not explicitive, and then I guess I'll figure out at the end of this podcast if I could put that down or not.
Oh, well, I think I blurted one out. I've been trying to control myself.
I don't
But
know if that counts.
I
Okay.
I thought I deserved prison at that point. So I showed up for my sentencing.
At this
And I
point,
still
the narcs, did they know that someone died around you?
No, they didn't know. So the amount of information I gave them, they were texting me, and I think I made up. I mean, they put a lot of pressure on me, and so I think I made up something one time, and then I kept leading them on, and then one time towards the end, there was a physical encounter with them. They somehow found me physically and pinned me and screamed that they needed information and stuff. So I was just about to tell them about this lead with the mafia person, but I was too paranoid to do that. And again, I was like, I can't stop.
Yeah, at that point, I don't know if it's paranoid or realistic also.
True. I mean, kind of like, yeah. I mean, I was afraid of prison, but then at the same time, it's like maybe I'll be safe in there. Oh. The ingredient that is missing from revealing the mafia guy was, I became so depressed. I became so, I mean, more depressed than I already was, that I started using more of the product than selling it. And so I owed this guy. Now he was like violent and murderous mafia. I owed him a lot of money. I know this sounds like a movie, but this is true. I owed him all this money and he was threatening my life. So I was like, I'm just gonna go to prison. Like, I don't want to live with the shame of ratting on somebody. This guy is scaring me, even though I would have to live with the fear of that the rest of my life. All these things.
So
Felicia,
you chose jail.
I chose jail. And then, but when I went up for my sentencing, just before the judge was gonna, tell, read me, sentence me, the prosecutor, federal, the United States federal prosecutor, asked for the case to be dismissed.
You're like,
What?
no, I wanted to go to
My
jail.
court-appointed lawyer, like this little heart of gold man, he pulled me into a side room afterwards, and he was like, "What did you do?" I'm like, "I don't know." He's like, "I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of cases. I don't. This never happens." I'm like, "I." He's like, "Dude," he's like, "Get out of here, kid. This is your second chance." And you would still think that that should
No,
be my
because
bio.
sometimes, no, that's what I'm saying. A lot of times people getting chances like that are not a chance, right? Because if you went to jail, you could have, like, number one, sobered up your brain so you could think clearly. Because at this point, you weren't. And now when you get away, this is why getting away with things is not compassionate. Because now you're just sent back to the same environment.
Exactly right. Exactly. So I called my mother after I was released, and hearing her sob uncontrollably, with the news that I was not going to prison, that got through to me. I mean, by the way, they were around, but I was pushing them away. They didn't know what to do with me. So, and they all knew what I was doing. I mean, my dad brought me, they came to the court the two times before that. My dad brought me to the interrogation. So they were around, but imagine dealing with me. That is incredibly overwhelming. But her sobbing on the phone, that got to me, and I was like, maybe I need to do something with this. I owe it to her, the other young man who died. I mean, all these things. And that didn't, I mean, but also to your point, at that time, I did not see myself as a criminal. I mean, I thought about it when people were, the courthouse people were looking at me in a certain way, and I'm like, why are they, wait, I'm
Well,
a
did you
criminal.
see yourself as someone with an addiction?
No, and that was my bottom, because I lasted 6 weeks more. I mean, I was so far from the idea of seeing that of myself from addiction, that 2 weeks before my 23rd birthday, my running mate, this beautiful soul, this girl, she and I bonded through this whole experience. She would run drugs for me, and she was the one person I like trusted and told everything. Like, she was my angel. But we were living in an abandoned apartment that would flood out because of the rain, and on an air mattress, like very classic sort of drug addict scenario. And she says to me, "I'm really scared to tell you this, but I want to go to rehab." And I remember looking at her and just cocking my head and being like, "You can do that?" Like, my idea of rehab was for people that were heroin addicts with like losing their arm in some haunted house on top of a hill. I did not even think it was for me. This, I'm smoking $400 or $500 worth of drugs a day in an abandoned apartment on an air mattress because the floors would flood out. Like,
How are
it
you
just didn't
getting all this
compute.
money? Is that from dealing?
Yeah. I mean, by that point, it was easy for me to, get fronted, whatever. And then it was always just,
but you also owed money to the mafia.
I was avoiding him. He didn't know where I was. So this was like hiding out in that abandoned place. But I knew enough of other dealers where I could get fronted something and I could go sell it and then pay them back and have a little bit. Like I knew how to go back and forth with just enough to have personal use and buy a hot dog and a Red Bull from 7-Eleven. Like that was the existence, back and forth, that kind of stuff. But I was like, oh, okay, I'll go to rehab too. And so 2 weeks later, when it became my 23rd birthday, when I decided I'd go to rehab, you know, after partying all night, like a going away party, and saying, okay, now is when I go, and suddenly watching my body on its own, still smoking the meth and doing its stuff, was the true shattering disillusionment moment of realizing once and for all, I had no control. I cannot stop. It shattered all illusions. And it was the weirdest experience. It was suddenly like I woke up from a coma and I was back in my body. And I remember looking around at all the paraphernalia and myself at what I was doing. And it was the first time where I was like, what is going on? Like, what the F? Like, what? Like it blew my mind. And this is the bottom. And a window opened. A very small window that I could see through, and it was a window that I knew was going to close soon, and I needed to act. I needed to jump through this window and ask for help. And luckily, you know, that running mate, that girl, she was downstairs. I crawled down the stairs to her. She saw me, took one look at me, and just started sobbing with me. We held each other. She was in that window with me, and we were like, what do we do? And we didn't know what to do. We pull out a Yellow Pages, called any rehab, and they were like, the city of DC rehab, whatever, they like, we have a bed open, but not until tonight. Can you make it till then? We're like, sure. But that window just started closing more and more. And she called her parents, which I was like, they're in Boston. What are they going to do? They got in the car a half an hour later and drove the whole 8-9 hours to come get her. And I was like, I got to call my mom. And I literally, the phone rang. It's Sunday morning. She's getting ready for church. She picks up the phone and she just hears me just say, Mom, in that cracked emotional way. And she just knew. And she goes, where are you? And that was it. That was the start.
How beautiful that you both had parents that would do that for you.
True. Very true. Very that. Yes.
As much don't have that.
As angry and resentful I was at her and continued to be for quite a number of years, I still had that.
Yeah. It's one of the things we do when we teach prevention is that to parents that if you make a little pact with your children, that if you get a little, you know, text with a purple emoji or whatever it is, or a baseball mitt, whatever code word you have, it means come get me. Don't ask any questions.
So my experience is not. Not the normal experience. Mine's quite extreme, especially with where it led to after 19 and everything I just revealed. It's funny you say that because my beautiful husband, who is, you know, has such a kind heart. And then when we first started dating, I didn't totally believe that until I met his parents. And I was like, oh, this is real. Like you have normal parents who like love you and are present and are in your life and pay attention and see you. And it was so fascinating to me. And they have that story of him at a high school party, just sending basically a coded text, and his dad came and got him. And I thought that was just so fascinating, yeah. But it's.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, I'd love to stay, but my parents won't let me, you know, they say I have to go see grandma tomorrow, whatever.
Right. And, you know, he and his brothers have, there's no signs of alcoholism or issues like that. I mean, they partake in alcohol, but most people do. But there isn't signs of heading in my extreme direction. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, yeah. So your parents came and got you, and you went to, and you, both you and this girl went to rehab.
So yeah, she got picked up, zoomed back up to Boston. I slept for 2 weeks in the basement of my parents' home. Literally slept probably that first week. I just it was
Well, that's meth crashing, right? Also.
Oh, for sure. Easily, yeah. Easily. And then October 8th, I entered a rehab, and I thought I was going to rehab to never do meth again, to never do party drugs again. I did not know much about alcoholism or the 12 steps. But when I was in rehab, I realized this is how I tricked myself. If I wanted to abstain from the drug dealing life or the party drugs, I needed to abstain from all of it. And so that's how I got myself to start my sobriety. Years into it, I was like, oh Lord, I was an alcoholic. Okay, I get it. I get it now. Full picture.
Did you have withdrawal from alcohol too?
No, but I would argue that there was times before going into this incident where, I would experience it like being like 19, 20, well before I was 21, where I would experience, you know, not tremors, but I would experience like, it's a better way of describing it. Just the come downs from alcohol were horrific until I'd get drunk again. I mean, I was every night at that point, starting to be every day as well.
So one time in rehab and it took so many people require several times.
Well, so I went from a rehab in Northern Virginia to the Whitman Walker Clinic in Washington, D.C., which is an outpatient program. And it's interesting. I was also benefited from the girl and I. She came back from Boston, and there was a wave of us who shared the same experience and the same sort of that she and I started a bit of a domino effect. And so outside of rehab, suddenly a lot of people we knew who were, you know, tweakers, addicts out there were starting to get sober too. So there was kind of like a pod of us that were really supporting each other in the 12 step rooms. And I really took to the 12 steps, thank God, because I would go to two meetings a day, work at a nonprofit, and go to this outpatient program at night. And so I built a lot of support before my brain could get me into any kind of trouble. And I had really great counselors at the outpatient program. And I also knew I had this vision and dream of being an actor. I have to say, having that purpose, that dream, it pulled me through a lot of the muck. It pulled me through a lot of it. In fact, I even thought while I was out there, I remember having so many movie incidences. I was like, I'm just doing research for when I'm writing and acting. It was like, come on, dude.
Which is kind of true, right?
You know what gave me more research was the amount of torment, angst, and suffering I had from like 13 to 23. That just, I feels like it just carved me out, like as a storyteller. Like I have a depth to me that I attribute to that.
Yeah. So it took and you got that and you maintained that. Did you have cravings or pulls?
So interesting. Okay, so so October 8th of 2004, October 8th, 2004, I entered rehab, but my sobriety date is 4/09/2005. And the reason is because one of the things that I would do in addition to all the other drugs that I would do was, you know, in the gay community, they love poppers, which is an inhalant, which is like not a thing. It's not really a thing, but I went to inhalants, like dust off.
What is it? What did you inhale?
Do you know, like, you know, dust off, like you'd spray it on computers.
Huffing. Yeah.
So you do that on,
it's usually a young boys thing.
Yeah, because or it can be a sexual thing, you know, a thing to put on top of the sexual experience. Or when I was first introduced to it was on the dance floor, interestingly enough.
I took care of a guy who had burns on his fingers from all the huffing he did.
Ooh, and again, I'm not disparaging, like a low key huffing is like poppers, which is like, sure, my gay community, they love that. That's fine. But I was doing this other level, you know, doing chemical dust off that anyway. When I went into a halfway house, as I was starting to rebuild my life, I walked into the halfway house. And immediately on top of the VCR was a can of dust off. And my brain was so confused. I was like, I'm entering a drug halfway house, and the first thing I see is this can of dust off. And the logic was, well, of course I can use it. It doesn't matter, because it doesn't count, because it's like a 90-second high. And so I used it that night, and then I told my counselor, and he goes, you have to start your day count over, and we're kicking you out of the halfway house. And I was like, what? I was devastated. I was like, what do you mean? Because my day count was so precious to me. I didn't realize that I actually broke my sobriety. And he's like, start it over. And so I was pissed off. And so that weekend, I was like, well, if I'm going to start my day count over, then I'm going to really go do it. And so I called some old friends and I went out and did some party drugs. I had the weirdest experience. I couldn't
That's
get
how
high.
people die now from fentanyl, right?
They go back. So, but
It's
fortunately,
the most
one,
deadly.
I didn't have fentanyl, but two, it was the weirdest thing. I just couldn't get high. And I remember so distinctly, they were all partying and high, and I took the same amount they did. And I'm just sitting there on the couch, and I stood up. I didn't say anything to anybody. I just stood up. I walked out. I got in my car, and I just started driving away from DC. And I was like, and I just knew it. I was like, this is the end. This is it. And that was it. That really was it. I was, because I realized in that moment, I don't belong out there. That's not my story anymore. And
And
so,
then, so where did you go? Did you go back to a different halfway
oh
house or?
no, I went back. So when they kicked me out of the halfway house, I went back home. And because my parents, again, they lived in Northern Virginia, right next to DC. And so I went home, and 6 months later, I had wonderful counselors at Whitman Walker, and he saw so much in me, and he was just like, not the one who kicked me out of the halfway house. That was another one. The other one that I really was like a mentor, he was like, listen, you have this vision, this dream of being this actor, and you've had some success at it. You need to go. You need to go to LA. And 6 months later, I moved out to LA. And fortunately for me, Los Angeles has had and continues to have some of the best 12-step recovery in the world. And with the advent of Zoom now after the pandemic, everybody has access to the recovery in LA and all over
So
the
how does that work? Because Hollywood television actors is just known to be full of drugs and alcohol. And here you want to be an alcohol, an actor, stay sober while you're in this sea, of drugs around you. First of all, is that true?
It says
Maybe it's not true.
no, it's just as true as any other industry. I mean, I could say the same for the financial industry, the banking, the lawyers. Like, it doesn't matter. I think we just like to comment on those that we think who are on Mount Olympus to normalize them, but it's just as true as any other community. At that time, though, my first 5 years, it was just about staying sober and building a life. So I went to two meetings a day and just worked and did classes and didn't really do much of anything. Then I started having more success, and then more Hollywood, as you say, experiences where no, it's just like, no, I'm not doing the cocaine, or I just stayed away, that kind of
So
thing.
you're able to do that. It's not like, hey, you're done filming for a whole day. Now everybody's going to the, after party, and you're like, no, nah, I don't need any of that.
No, God, no. And thank God. I mean, nowadays it's like, one, it's starting to become really cool to be sober. Two,
Oh, I
it's
love hearing that.
oh, no, true story. I mean, there's like non-alcoholic liquor and beer specific bars popping up, or stores popping up. It's really like sobriety, being sober, has drastically changed. It used to be a thing. That's why it was an anonymous program, because there was so much shame around it. But now it's like, no, bro, I'm sober, and it's like totally fine and
I don't know, that's
respectful.
refreshing to hear, because all I see is, the governor of California passing consumption lounges where you could use marijuana and, and without provisions of driving safety after that.
That part, I mean, yeah, the driving part should be like, yeah. I mean, decriminalizing marijuana is, I mean, that's one of the tamer things. But I know that there, I don't know, the more.
There's a difference between decriminalizing, which I don't know anybody who's against decriminalizing, okay? But or versus normalizing, and pushing that on our youth, which we've done in California.
True. I mean, there is a pot shop every other block around here, and that kind of stuff. It allows, though, for I don't know. I like the conversation. Like, I used to be like, God damn it. Why are they gonna? I used to be so against it. And I'm now like more ambivalent. Like,
Against what?
everybody,
Oh.
like, just like, why would they legalize pot? I mean, that was more me being afraid of using it or something. Like, how dare they? But now I'm just like, to each their own with their own journey.
Ah, I need to convert you. Did you hear what Elton John said? Elton John said, and he's a man in recovery, said that legalizing marijuana is the worst thing that's ever happened to the United States or Canada. Again, this is not your daddy's pot anymore.
That's a true.
They're
That's
selling
true.
99% THC product. That's like selling meth.
I there there I do agree that there should be some sort of regulation on the amount of THC that definitely
Potencies.
for yeah oh that
Yeah.
mean for sh apps. Absolutely. Or the amount you can purchase, or the amount of
Or advertising or
advertising
childproof
apps.
packaging, so our ERs aren't full of babies who
Absolutely.
are in the ICU because they got into their mom's gummy. And there's a lot that
Oof.
we haven't that that remains a problem. But I'm really encouraged about you saying that being sober can be cool in Hollywood, because I think that that's what our nation needs. Our nation needs heroes, celebrities, that make it cool to be sober.
I'm not giving anything away by saying like Tom Holland, the Spider-Man, he's sober and he talks about it all the time now. So he's part of
Awesome.
the younger generation. There's a long list. I mean, it is effective because when I moved to LA, in my first few months, I went to a meeting and I'm sitting there and then I turned to my right and suddenly I realized this person next to me is the lead singer from one of my favorite bands. And he's just saying, "Hey man, how are you? Like, I'm a normal person." And I was so blown away and so inspired because he was sober and he cared about my sobriety and it really affected me. So there is truth to that statement. Like,
Yeah.
okay.
So
It's.
in my generation, we had Brooke Shields, right? Who's like the hottest young woman star. And the ad that she did that really, I think, helped change things as far as smoking cigarettes, it was like, that's like kissing an ashtray. That's like,
Ooh. And everybody's like, yeah, that is right.
yeah,
That
that's kind of
is true.
right. And it made it un because before it was so cool to
Yeah.
smoke.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seemed like everybody smoked. At the peak, it was only like 40 something percent of the population smoked, and it seemed like everybody was smoking.
Right.
But they had a whole campaign to make it uncool, and I would love to see that again in movies and in celebrities to show that it's, you know what, we're having fun without alcohol, without pot or drugs.
No, the tides are shifting. No, the tides are absolutely shifting. I think there's gonna always be drugs and alcohol, but to the point where, in my generation, at least, being in the 90s, what cool meant was like you can handle your drugs and alcohol and you smoke. Like that was cool. And that's what a lot of Hollywood, my first couple of years, my first couple Hollywood parties, it did kind of seem like that. But working more, being around it more, and the shift in the sobriety community being, far more accepted, is telling me the tides are turning to, again, to the point where I think it's becoming, how do I say this? More than cool, because again, the program's anonymous. We're told not to talk about it because there was a time 50 years ago when it carried a whole amount of shame.
Right.
People don't care that you're an alcoholic now at all. If they do, it's a sign that they have alcoholism.
Yeah,
But now.
the whole stigma campaign, there's a whole push about stigma, remove the stigma from the user, which the slippery slope is, I don't want stigma to you. You're a human being, a beautiful young man. But I do want stigma on the drugs. Those are bad. I don't want you using them.
I absolutely agree with that, and doing it in a way where, if you Like the Mormons were like, just don't do it, it's bad. But my brain was always like, but why is it bad? Can you tell me why it's bad? And it made me want to do it more. I'm not blaming them. I'm not blaming them in any way. I'm just
Right.
using that as an example. But so there's a way of doing this
Yeah,
where
there should be an explanation, especially if you're curious and you want to know why, you should get an answer. Otherwise, it makes you more curious.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And
Right?
also
And we do that a lot,
rebellious.
like don't cross the street when the sign is red, and don't touch something. I'm thinking
Don't
like
tell me what to do.
grandkids.
Yeah.
Right, or like I'm thinking, I have a granddaughter who's like 1 year old. It's like, don't touch the hot stove. Why? Because it'll hurt. I mean, there's a reason we say no. Because you love someone, you say no.
I know I hear that that analogy all the time in the rooms where, don't touch the hot stove, and then addicts are always like, I'm gonna touch the hot stove. Don't tell me what to do, but
Yeah.
yeah, but I mean, I would like to see that trend as well. Just
Well,
more.
you're part of that. You're part of that. You have a big career and a whole movie deal out of your new coming book.
Hey, and
Yeah,
I mean, obviously it's going to be about sobriety and being, being more
think that's
vocal about
awesome.
that.
And I also feel like we need to learn from people like you who've reached recovery or living in recovery in order to better advise treatment to people who are suffering.
I've learned a
Right?
lot, yeah.
Because as a physician in the medical community, we always push our medical ways, but there's many different ways. And we need to learn what works for different people so we could advise better. Not one size fits all. So I think that that's important. That's why I wanted to hear your story, because it could help other people and people who are struggling now. And there's a lot to learn from you. So good little drug lord, tell us about that.
So I am going to circle back, or you can put in the notes when I have the
Yeah.
publication date. It is a memoir, as I've already said. Part of it is a message in a bottle to a grieving mother who's out there somewhere. Hopefully I find her. The other part is I wrote it in a very intentionally, it feels like fiction, the rise and fall of the drug dealing and the informing, and because I wanted it to be, I wanted
Readable.
I remember when I started, after reading many other memoirs, I remember when I started writing this, I literally said out loud, like, I was like, ugh, I just don't want this to be sad. And I was like, oh, that's a good title. And that was my title for the first like 6 months, because I just didn't want it to be sad. And so I wrote it in a very, it feels like fiction, that's intentional, and it's entertaining. I want it to be entertaining. I want you to turn the page. I want you to be on the ride with me. At the same time, I go in every other chapter or every other few chapters, I go backwards in time, because I needed to understand backwards to my, childhood, what happened there that led to this even happening, but more importantly, that led to this moment where, again, I thought I was a good person, and I know I was inebriated, I know I was paranoid, I know I was all the things, yet I let somebody die. And not only that, there is a grieving mother out there who I could have helped and stopped 20 more years of grieving if she's still alive, if she found a way on. I don't know. I don't know any of those things. So, The Good Little Drug Lord will be out soon, and you will have the publication date when I have it.
That's awesome. Well, we'll definitely pr promote that.
Thank
And
you.
do you have dreams of it being a movie as well?
Well, so far, for me, it was just getting to this point, and then everybody who's read it, the first thing they ask is like, "Have you?"
Was it going to be a
Do,
movie?
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just kind of, it seems inevitable now at this point. But when and how to tell that story will be an interesting reveal. We'll see. But yeah, I mean, I'm open to it. Let's say that.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Thank you, Sean. Hermione's wonderful. I'm thankful, really, that you're alive and well and now and thriving,
Thank you.
and using that experience in a positive way, like you're doing. So I'm proud of you.
I never tire of hearing that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.